Listen, Igor.
You're listening to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. I hope that you all have your thinking caps on and are ready to use them. Hope you have pen and paper by your side. Those of you who have tape recorders, I hope you're recording this broadcast. Because, ladies and gentlemen, this is going to leave you sitting on the edge of your seats. And is going to expand your consciousness, if there is such a thing. Don't go away. You're going to want to hear every single word during the next 2 hours. July 17th, 1996, 8:31 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Transworld Airlines Flight 800 suffered a catastrophic event at 13,700 feet. None of the 230 passengers or crew survived. Now, 7 months later, officials cannot or will not tell us what happened to Flight 800. Chairman of the National Transportation and Safety Board said, "What you have at stake here is the credibility of this agency and the credibility of the government to run an investigation." This is taken from Relevance Magazine, and you're going to get information from all sources this afternoon. No conclusions, ladies and gentlemen, are being reached about what caused the disaster. However, a gradual sea change in the direction of the investigation is coming sharper into focus. Just as a large oil tanker requires much time and room to reverse course on the high seas, the leading theory on the cause of this disaster has, in the space of 7 months and in the absence of any supporting evidence, shifted 180 degrees from foul play to mechanical failure. Of course, large tankers need a little help in changing course. And in the Flight 800 investigation, the major media has, like a busy tugboat, begun pushing the concept of an elusive and scientifically creative mechanical failure explanation. On the front page of the New York Times, comprehensive December 15th investigation of the crash, we learn from the heat of the summer to the first snows of winter, there's been a striking shift among many investigators from the initial presumption of sabotage with a slim chance of mechanical malfunction to a presumption of malfunction with a slim chance of sabotage. As recently as November, ladies and gentlemen, the authoritative Aviation Week and Space Technology magazine stated, officials investigating the disintegration of Transworld Airlines Flight 800 are unconvinced that a mechanical failure downed the 747 and fear the current emphasis by senior investigators on such a failure could hamper the search for the actual causes of that crash. That's from Aviation Week and Space Technology, November the 11th, 1996. Earlier, the October 21st issue of the same... magazine quoted a former TWA maintenance official. With all the time, hours, and configurations that the 747 has been flown in, I can't even begin to think of some part of the airplane that failed to cause this tragedy. The magazine cited other 747 engineers who agreed. The leading candidate, thought by investigators to have brought down the mighty jumbo, we're told by the New York Times that investigators now theorize that a cross-feed manifold fuel line could have sprung a pinhole leak, possibly through a coupling that holds pieces of the line together, and that a fine spray of fuel would have then created a static field. The static could have generated a spark, perhaps between the gap of the ends of a safety wire used to secure the fuel line coupling joints. And that's about as probable as an alien spacecraft putting extraterrestrial eliminators on board to rip that aircraft apart piece by piece. It's not going to fly, ladies and gentlemen. Needless to say, the notion of a minute static electricity charge causing such a catastrophic structural failure of this Boeing 747, which has waited millions of flying hours to reveal itself, is widely ridiculed by those in the airline industry, especially the pilots who fly through lightning storms, which release electric charges millions of times more powerful than this one that is being theorized. In mid-December, even though they had not determined the cause of the crash, the National Transportation and Safety Board announced recommendations for keeping jetliner fuel tanks from filling with dangerous fumes are heating to a dangerous level. As the battle against in-flight static electricity charges up, folks, FAA regulations designed to reduce passengers scuffing their shoes on the carpet can't be too far behind. But instead of straining to comprehend this rarefied statistical probability of a static charge bringing down a jumbo, even the Times and its sources admit often the exact spark is never found. We should look at the far more concrete evidence of a missile hitting this aircraft. Because, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to tell you right now, just in case some of you have to be somewhere pretty soon, that is exactly what has happened. And before this broadcast is over, you will have been presented with all the proof you need to understand that a missile brought down TWA Flight 800. If the media was a tugboat pushing away from the truth, the comments of White House spokesman Michael McCurry were like a giant iceberg sticking out of the water, menacing any officials daring to publicly advance the missile theory. Mere days after the crash, he sneered, quote, "There isn't any United States official with half a brain who's suggesting anything like that," end quote. Of course, it was perfectly all right for American officials to speculate about bombs and send infinitesimal static sparks. The few who held on to a missile scenario peddled the easily discredited shoulder-launched Stinger missile theory. When respected journals like James Intelligence Review discounted this as highly unlikely, the press wrote off all other missile theories with it. Now here is some of the evidence, ladies and gentlemen. Listen very closely. The Washington Times of July the 24th reported that several witnesses, not one, not two, not three, but several. Witnesses saw a bright, flare-like object streaking toward the jumbo jet seconds before it blew up. ABC News said that the investigators had more than 100 eyewitness accounts supporting the missile theory. The intelligence service alone, ladies and gentlemen, has located over 150 eyewitnesses who saw a missile rise up from the surface of the ocean, fly up in an arc or parabolic flight pattern, and strike TWA 800, resulting in a gigantic fireball, which, of course, caused this aircraft to disintegrate and fall into the water. The September 22nd New York Post revealed law enforcement sources said the hardest evidence gathered so far overwhelmingly suggests a surface-to-air missile. The Post cited a total of 154 credible witnesses interviewed by the FBI out of the total of over 3,000 witnesses, some 300 of which described seeing a missile rise up from the water and hit that aircraft. The December 15th New York Times cited reports of streaking lights from nearly 40 reliable witnesses, including a pilot and a military officer. Investigators talked with several of those interviewed by the FBI and learned that among this group were engineers, pilots, lawyers, doctors, policemen, scientists, and others believed to be both credible and more than capable of giving accurate information about the event. A school bus driver, Ronald Penny, is one of several dozen eyewitnesses who saw something going up toward the plane prior to the explosion. He described it as a pencil-thin white trail rising up that hit the plane. That's from Newsday, September 1st, 1996. When we questioned a naval missile expert, without any mention of Flight 800, to describe the appearance of an in-flight modern surface-to-air missile, he stated, quote, "When it approaches the target, it looks like a pencil," end quote. Penny's account is representative of the more credible witnesses and one of the most revealing of those that we interviewed. It was relaxing with a group of 8 family and friends on the dock at what's known as the Barrier Beach, directly opposite what would become a scene of devastation, when his friend, a pilot, pointed out to the ocean and said, quote, "Look at this. We're going to have a fireworks display," end quote. Penny looked up in time to see the last second or two of a pencil-thin light pointing up into the sky. We thought it was fireworks or a flare. After it went up, all of a sudden, it just stopped dead like it hit a brick wall, and then a half second later, there was a bright light like a flash bulb, and then it started to descend, and it went down for a few seconds, and there was a red-orange fireball which got bigger until it was the size of the top of a quart jar if you held it at arm's length. But then it broke in two. End quote. For the first time, Penny and others could see the outline of an aircraft of some sort. Penny doesn't know whether it was a missile, but as he told reporters immediately after the crash, quote, "It was something going up that hit that plane," end quote. Reportedly, several fishermen on a dredger in a scallop boat, which was so close to the fireball that they feared the plane would fall on them, also maintained that something shot up from the surface of the water and hit the plane. Lou Deseron told ABC World News Sunday on July 21st, quote, "We saw what appeared to be a flare going straight up. As a matter of fact, we thought it was from a boat. It was a bright reddish-orange color," end quote. Major Fred Meyer, a decorated Vietnam combat rescue helicopter pilot, was approaching the runway in an Air National Guard HH-60 Pave Hawk helicopter, similar to the Army's Black Hawk, about 10 to 12 miles from the crash at the 106th Air National Guard Rescue Wing at Gabreski Airport. Meyer, co-pilot Christian Bauer, and radioman Dennis Richardson saw the explosion from their vantage point, hovering about 100 to 200 feet off the ground. Major Meyer told relevance that he was not permitted to talk on the record, and he referred us to the public affairs officer, Major Jim Finkel, who revealed that the FBI had asked the National Guard Adjutant General to order Major Meyer and the other airmen who had seen Flight 800 explode to cease making statements to the press. The Adjutant General complied, and the gag order has persisted for months and is still in effect. The reason given, ladies and gentlemen, was that the press was misquoting them and taking them out of context. Another non-military witness, Paul Angelides, told investigators that the FBI advised him that it was best that he not talk to the press or others about what he saw. Investigators obtained a tape of the Air Guard pilot's press conference shortly after the crash. Major Meyer recalled seeing an object that had the appearance of a shooting star. This comment was later twisted by the media, which tried to suggest that Meyer saw a shooting star. He repeatedly emphasized that what he actually saw was a streak of light. At the time of the crash, it was mere minutes after the moment of sunset, and the sky was still very bright. The veteran pilot stated, quote, "I saw what appeared to be the sort of course and trajectory that you see when a shooting star enters the atmosphere, and I was very curious because it was bright and you can't see that during daylight," end quote. He continued, quote, "Almost immediately thereafter, I saw in rapid succession a small explosion and then a large explosion, and the large explosion engulfed the small explosion into a huge fireball that just then began to fall very slowly in the sky," end quote. Although, ladies and gentlemen, it is still unclear, many believe that what Meyer saw was the final moments of a missile arcing toward the 747 jet. Pararescueman Tex Sergeant Craig Johnson, who was collecting his gear after jumping from a C-130 onto the same airfield, reported, "I saw an object falling out of the sky. It was a red-orange object. It looked like a circle. I was keeping my eye on it because it was very unusual. Then I saw a large explosion." A source close to the investigation, who spoke on condition of anonymity, told investigators that the FBI took surveyors along with each of the nearly three dozen witnesses who saw something come up from the ocean and went to the spots where they claimed to have seen the bright streaks leave the ocean's surface. The surveyors plotted the estimated positions where the objects left the horizon, the course of the object, and the location of the explosion. Despite the different perspectives, the witnesses' recollections were internally consistent to a remarkable degree. Because the witnesses were at different locations along the beach or in the water, the investigators were able to triangulate the different perspectives and obtain a fix on the approximate location of the missile's launch. The W-105 Naval Testing Warning Area. In addition to the 154 credible eyewitnesses, some heard the delayed sounds of the debacle. Paul Angelides, still stunned from seeing the fireball, his description was very similar to that of Major Meyer, also became an ear witness to the event. He remembers several seconds elapsing before he heard a long rumble that sounded like rolling thunder. Standing in his living room, looking out over the carnage, he heard the staccato sound of three distinct explosions, which he recounts sounded like heavy artillery. Then it was quiet for 10 seconds. Then I heard two secondaries, a boom and then another boom, separated by a few seconds. Angelides, an engineer who lives on West Hampton Beach, almost directly opposite the blast, remembers the booms shook his chest and the entire house. The first three explosions may have been related to the initial event, while the booms may correspond to the sound of the massive fuselage hitting the water. The staccato heavy artillery sounds could indicate either the initial crippling event of a missile destroying the plane or the fuel tanks igniting. The latter is more likely, considering the fact that the initial event and the red fireball were separated in time by anywhere from 4 to 20 seconds. Now, this time separation, ladies and gentlemen, between the initial event and the fireball is supported by the recollections of David McLean, who was a former Navy pilot with 30 years of flying experience, who was piloting an East Wind Airlines 737 at 17,000 feet just north of Flight 800 over West Hampton Beach. He spotted, and I quote his exact words, "a big bright light that looked a little off color to me. It had a yellowish tint to it, but I had thought it might have been a landing light. I watched it for a good 20 seconds before it blew up." McLean told investigators he doesn't recall seeing a missile prior to the event. He then radioed Boston saying, "There's been an in-flight explosion." Other pilots then began reporting the disaster. One of them was Sven Ferret, whom I have personally communicated with, who was flying a small private plane over Riverhead, further inland about 19 miles due north of the crash. Like Captain McLean, he and his passenger noted what they thought were landing lights and commented that it was probably commercial airline traffic. Ferret told me that as they watched the light, it erupted in a tremendous fireball. They then flew over to the scene as they reported the incident. Ferret maneuvered the plane to the top of the huge smoke plume left by the fireball and checked his altimeter. It was exactly 7,700 feet at the top of the plane's landing light seen by Ferret and McLean was actually the burning plane descending, possibly already shorn of its front end, after it had suffered the initial crippling event at 12,700 feet. It also suggests, ladies and gentlemen, that the bright streak of light or red object descending that was seen by Paul Anglides, Major Meyer, and the pararescue men was actually the burning plane after the initial catastrophe. And the huge fireball, seen by so many, most likely represents the ignition of the massive amount of liquid fuel stored in one or both wings. The Times reveals, quote, "Soot in the vents running from the center tank to the wingtips indicates a fire, but not the direction it traveled or when it happened," end quote. The New York Times, December 15, 1996. The heated vapors in this largely empty center fuel tank might have blown first, accounting for the initial small explosion seen by Fred Meyer and others. This would have been followed within a second or two by the massive blast of the wing tanks, whose jet fuel would ignite with a telltale bright red orange color and what many witnesses described as thick black smoke. Newsday's August 20th, 1996 issue quoted Larry Citarelli, owner of Citarelli's Market in East Mauritius, whose customers included the investigators of the disaster, among whom the missile theory caused quite a buzz. He added, quote, "Everyone thinks it's so far-fetched, but the people who seem to be in the know are saying it's the furthest thing from being far-fetched," end quote. Now, there's a lot of other evidence, ladies and gentlemen, and all of it must be considered and put into its proper perspective. Remember, we're assembling two puzzles, always. One is the deception, and the other is the truth. And in between, we have a large box with a question mark on it. Anything that will not fit into either of the puzzles goes into that box. Nothing is ever thrown away. A photograph was taken by Heidi Krieger of her friend standing on a boat, and it shows a pencil-thin vertical line. It was taken just seconds prior to the plane crash, and in the area of the sky that the fireball appeared. In a telling comment, Krieger stated, quote, "I think it is a missile only because I have this photograph. Otherwise, I would believe whatever is on television," end quote. That is from Newsday, September 1st, 1996. The FBI confiscated the negative and has made no determination on their significance, neither have they allowed the negatives to be viewed by any independent investigators, nor have they ever been returned, nor are they likely to ever be returned. Meanwhile, just a few short miles up the beach to the northeast, Linda Cabot was shooting photos of a political fundraising party at Docker's Restaurant in the village of QQ. Although she and her husband Lance would not discover it until a week later, one of the photos, taken between 8:15 and 8:45 p.m., the explosion occurred at 8:31 p.m., contained a long, thin, cylindrical object in the upper right-hand corner of a snapshot of several partygoers at dusk. The object, which Lance noticed while looking for any images of Flight 800's descent on the party pictures, is slanted with the right end pointing slightly upwards. The right end has a faint glow, which some have suggested is the exhaust of a missile. Assuming the glow is a missile exhaust, it would suggest that it was heading in the general southwesterly or westerly direction of the plane's fireball. Now, this photo, ladies and gentlemen, has caused quite a stir. And when it was released in a full-color centerfold in the French monthly Paris Match on November 7th and was reportedly a contributing factor in journalist Pierre Salinger's coming forward with charges that the Navy may have accidentally shot down the jumbo jet, the world felt a tremor of fear. Interestingly, the object's contour appears very similar to a cruise missile. One would think the partygoers would have heard something, since it would be a buzzing by at under 100 yards away. The Cabots point out that the music was very loud at the time. Linda Cabot was facing north at the time of the snapshot, which puts the proposed missile on a roughly southwesterly course, which is the general direction from the restaurant to the area of Flight 800's demise. However, even if it is a cruise missile, they don't reach altitudes of 12,000 feet, and they are not designed to hit aircraft. In fact, I have never in my life ever heard of even a test attempt to shoot down an aircraft using a cruise missile, which, ladies and gentlemen, cost billions of dollars apiece. However, it has been suggested that a cruise missile may have been acting as a target drone for a Navy surface-to-air missile, which may have confused the drone with the jumbo owing to the larger ability of the jetliner to reflect special radar paint indiscriminately bounced off it by a distant missile cruiser. And we'll discuss the friendly fire theory later, ladies and gentlemen. Brought to you by Swiss America Trading. They specialize in non-reportable, non-confiscatable hard assets. They've been sponsoring this program so long that I don't even really remember when it started, except it had to have been about 4.5 years ago. That's a long time. They have been forever loyal in their support of the message of this broadcast, and of the awakening of the American people. And I believe that that demands some loyalty and support from the listeners to this broadcast who appreciate and depend upon the information obtained from the hour of the time. Now, it is clear to anyone who has studied the history of money and economics, and in particular, economies supported by paper, such as Federal Reserve notes, with no backing whatsoever of any commodity whatsoever, of any kind whatsoever, other than the full faith and credit of the United States government, which, ladies and gentlemen, means nothing. It is a fantasy that you create in your mind. You see, money by definition must have an intrinsic value, which means it must have self-worth, worth in and of itself, a value that everyone recognizes. If it does not, it cannot and never will be money. And sometime this week, I'm going to play again Stephen Jacobson's Wake Up America. So those of you who do not understand money or economics will, because it's the best education in the world and it all takes place in 1 hour. That's all there is to it. I urge you, folks, understanding the history of money and economics and knowing what has happened in the past with good money systems versus false counterfeit paper systems, to put at least a portion of your assets into real money, which has always been and always will be gold and silver coin. So call Swiss America Trading right now, 1-800-289-2646. Ask them for a current copy of the newsletter. Thank them for sponsoring the hour of the time. Tell them how much you really appreciate their loyalty and their backing of this broadcast. And then ask how you can get your hands on some real money. And don't take any guff or argument about what you should invest. Tell them what you can afford. That's the way to do it. When you tell them what you can afford, they can figure out a plan just for you. You see, you don't have to have a whole lot of money to do this. You can accumulate an account over a period of time. And when you have enough to purchase what you want to purchase, they will simply send it to you. Or you can purchase, say, one small coin every month, or every 2 weeks, or every 2 months, whatever you want to do. But it is important that you do it. Not as an investment, hoping that the price of gold or silver is going to go through the roof and you're going to rake in a big killing from the commodities market, because gold and silver is a commodity. Don't do that, folks. Put at least a portion of your assets into gold and silver coin to protect those assets. Because gold and silver only fluctuates, ladies and gentlemen, according to the confidence in the counterfeit paper system. If there's a lot of confidence in paper, the price of gold and silver goes down. But if there's a lot of confidence in paper, ladies and gentlemen, that means that there is a continuing inflationary effect upon what you can buy and what you cannot. You see, 1 ounce of gold will purchase exactly the same number of loaves of bread today that it would 1,000 years ago, or 500 years ago, or 200 years in the future. It's always been that way and always will be that way. And in times of war, governments collapsing, the collapse of economies, runaway and rampant, terrible inflationary periods, those who have possessed gold and silver coin have been the only ones who have survived in any kind of a meaningful manner. So please, take advantage of this situation and call Swiss America Trading, 1-800-289-2646. That's 1-800-289-2646. 2646. Do it now. You'll be so glad that you did. The great weight will come from off your shoulders, and you'll know that you've taken care of some of the business that you're supposed to take care of. And if that's too hard to remember, you can remember this. 1-800-BUY-COIN. Do it now. Don't wait. Don't procrastinate. Naturally, ladies and gentlemen, any large plane, and most small planes, are tracked by radar during flight. I mean, that's just a normal part of maintaining the safety of our flight lanes. The FAA's New York radar followed Flight 800 and noted a blip merging with the plane. This is powerful evidence. The Federal Aviation Administration's New York radar followed Flight 800 and noted a blip merging with the plane. The Associated Press Wire Service reported the radar evidence as follows, quote, radar detected a blip merging with the jet shortly before the explosion, something that could indicate a missile hit, end quote. From the Associated Press, July 19, 1996. The New York Times of December 15, 1996, reported on an emergency meeting just 5.5 hours after the tragedy. Quote, and at 2 a.m. the next day, top intelligence and security officials were told in a video teleconference from the White House Situation Room that radar tapes showed an object headed for the plane before it exploded. Days later, the object was found to be an electronic anomaly. End quote. And if you believe that, I've got a bunch of bridges to sell you. That's right, folks. The ever-present senior administration officials leaked to the press, under the convenient condition of anonymity, that the blip was, to use their term, quote, spurious, end quote. Of course, this one word was all it took to send the press puppies running off, wagging their tails, looking for something other than a missile to explain the disaster. You see, you already have enough evidence right now that I've given you on the first one quarter of this broadcast to prove to any jury in any courtroom anywhere that a missile hit that plane. And there's more, much more. What about all those satellites, ladies and gentlemen, which scan the earth looking for the signature of a nuclear missile launch? Wouldn't they have caught it? Yes, of course, in the case of a massive nuclear missile launch, but it would depend on the timing as to whether a smaller surface-to-air missile would be detected. U.S. Space Command officials confirmed to Aviation Week and Space Technology that the Defense Support Program satellite, DSP, recorded the activity in that area at the time of the crash and did detect a flash, although it was believed to be Flight 800 exploding. Although the apparatus did not detect a missile launch, they conceded that, quote, the sensor uses a sweep motion that could miss a short-duration launch, end quote. Aviation Week and Space Technology, July 29, 1996. And remember, the satellite is not designed to pick up the launch of a surface-to-air missile. Only the launch of an intercontinental ballistic missile. However, the New York Post reported a law enforcement official's account from satellite pictures presumably a different satellite system than the DSP. And folks, there are a lot of satellites up there all taking pictures of the Earth at the same time. These pictures, which purportedly showed an object rapidly ascending to Flight 800, passing it, then changing course and colliding with it. The account was also reported in the July 22, 1996 edition of the Times of London. New York Newsday reported on September 1st that the radar from Islip, New York, recorded the missile rising, tracking toward the plane, circling to the front of the plane, and then disappearing in the plane's underbelly. What is most interesting is the fact that the FBI, which is running the investigation and which possesses all such hard evidence, will not release it for independent analysis. Thus, not even a copy of the radar or satellite images in question have been provided to the press, despite the fact that it could presumably allay widespread suspicions of a friendly fire incident involving a Navy missile. Flight 800, ladies and gentlemen, was initially believed to have been the work of terrorists who had somehow planted a bomb on board the plane. Within weeks of the recovery of much of the wreckage, the investigators were able to effectively rule out the bomb theory. There was a brief flurry in which the New York Times announced official site proof that device exploded in cabin of Flight 800. But this was the product of the lying communist news networks and the communist-controlled print. You see, because it was soon shown to be residue from a training session with bomb-sniffing dogs, which was conducted in June in the same plane, and which involved real explosives placed in the same areas where the residue was detected. They also have failed to mention that this same type of residue can be found in one very common type of heart medicine. Not only was no explosive residue found, but the pattern of the breakup inside the plane did not suggest a bomb, ladies and gentlemen. In a September 23, 1996 report, Pat Milton of the Associated Press quoted a source who spoke on condition of anonymity. Quote, there is no evidence of it exploding inside the aircraft, end quote. There would have been all kinds of blast damage if it did, and we are just not seeing that. End quote. The reports of a death of blast damage resulted in the reflexive assumption by the media that the lack of such damage and of explosive residues effectively ruled out not only a bomb but a missile too. Of course, the government should and does know better. The December 15, 1996, New York Times conceded that those in the FBI who were pushing the missile theory had developed an excellent case. Quote, but once the FBI's missile team got its assignment, they worked the theory so hard that they wound up with a persuasive scenario for how it could have happened, but with no evidence of a missile blast, their theory mutated, end quote. Now perhaps, folks, to a layman, there was no evidence of a missile blast. But not to a military expert in modern surface-to-air missile warheads and their scientifically calculable effects on aircraft. Brigadier General Benton K. Parton, United States Air Force retired, who worked with us on the Oklahoma City bombing of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building, spent 31 years in active service in the Air Force, and headed advanced weapons systems design teams, including particular specialization in the area of guided weapons technology. He was intimately involved with the development of some of the smart bombs later used in the Persian Gulf War. On October 4th, after studying the damage pattern evident in the Flight 800 explosion, General Parton sent a letter to the National Transportation Safety Board, citing the likelihood that the destruction was caused by what is known as a continuous rod warhead. He wrote, quote, a proximity-fused continuous rod missile warhead is the only target destruction system I know that would be consistent with all damage assessment information I have seen in the open media. The destructive mechanism is unique to that type of warhead. You would not see blast or blast frag damage. Neither would you see residuals from explosives. The instantaneous kill is unique to that warhead type. End quote. Now, contrary to the popular conception of how missiles work, those carrying a continuous rod warhead do not slam into the plane, nor do they deliver a high explosive charge which blows up the plane. Instead, ladies and gentlemen, they fly up to the target until they are approximately 50 feet away from it, at which time a relatively small explosion occurs. According to both Parton and experts at the Navy's Surface Warheads Division, this small, distant explosion is not likely to leave significant explosive residue or to produce any blast damage to the plane. Rather, the small explosion hurls out an expanding steel rod arrangement, like an accordion, unfolding perpendicular to the missile's path, which amounts to a ring of steel expanding outward at 6,000 feet per second. In effect, several times the muzzle velocity of a high-powered rifle. Now, this ring of steel rods, each no more than a few inches around, expands to a diameter of 50 to 100 feet until, as General Parton described to investigators, quote, it slices through the target like a saber. If the missile approaches the plane from the side, it will cut off a wing. If it approaches from the front, as was the likely case in Flight 800, it will slice the fuselage in two. End quote. What's more, a frontal approach would mean that the missile, after the steel ring is released, would continue streaking off in the opposite direction of the plane and land in the ocean many miles away, never to be found. The rod ring expands outward until it breaks up and the individual rods, each 1 to 1.5 feet long, fly off into the sky in different directions. Very little identifiable evidence would remain. The Naval Air Warfare Center Weapons Division describes the deadly device as, quote, a sort of flying buzzsaw, end quote. A Naval Academy text explained the principle thusly, quote, a group of rods are bundled together in a continuous hoop by welding their ends together in an accordion fashion. The bundle is arranged radially around the main charge. Upon detonation, the rod bundle expands radially outward until the rods are fully extended, at which time the hoop begins to break up. The rod hoop acts as a buzzsaw and is capable of cutting sections of an aircraft in half. Investigators, ladies and gentlemen, sent General Parton a copy of the NTSB's computerized diagram of the way the plane is believed to have broken up in the sky. Interestingly, this diagram was accidentally released by the NTSB to family members and was later leaked to the press. When our initial requests for the diagram were denied, an NTSB employee told investigators it was not supposed to have been released. This official diagram only added to the general suspicions that the continuous rod warhead was involved. Furthermore, General Parton is of the opinion that judging from the pattern seen in the NTSB diagram, two missiles armed with continuous rod warheads likely destroyed this aircraft, slicing at once where the leading edge of the wing joins the fuselage, and again roughly 30 feet in front of that point. They would have been fired a few milliseconds apart, and if traveling in tandem, at great distances, would have appeared to onlookers as a single streak of light. In fact, sending two missiles to destroy a target is standard procedure, as was seen in both the accidental downing of the Iranian Airbus by the United States ship Vincennes in 1988, and the deliberate shoot-down of the KAL-747 Flight 007 by the Soviet Air Force over Sakhalin Island in the early 1980s. The continuous rod warhead was originally designed to bring down bombers with what General Parton described as a K-kill. He explained, A functional kill would disable the workings of the aircraft, but it might still be able to fly on over the target city and release its bombs. The structural kill, or K-kill, of a continuous rod warhead is designed to bring the plane down immediately, end quote. Now, modern U.S. Navy weapons systems have shifted emphasis from bomber defense and have evolved into almost exclusively blast fragmentation warheads, which focus on producing the less effective functional kill. Thus, Parton's hypothesis hurts the friendly fire explanation, since the United States Navy has, in the last 15 years, shifted production to the more modern blast fragmentation warheads. The Navy public affairs officer told investigators that continuous rod warheads are still found on United States ships, but they are uncommon and would be unlikely to be used during advanced missile testing. Like the continuous rod warhead, the blast fragmentation device explodes before it reaches the target and sends out a barrage of metal spheres, one of which, according to a Navy warhead expert, could fit in the palm of your hand. Now, similar in principle to a shotgun, this warhead sends the spheres slamming into the plane at several times the speed of sound. According to the Navy expert, they can rip out vital wiring and communications and other electrical and mechanical elements in the target aircraft and may tear off parts of the wing or even puncture the fuel tank. However, they are less effective at producing the instantaneous structural kill of a continuous rod warhead, especially when the target is a jumbo jet. General Parsons also informed the NTSB that he had performed the initial design, development, and testing of the first continuous rod warheads for the Bismarck missile in the 1950s. Despite his impeccable credentials and the fact that he provided a plausible mechanism which would explain what has thus far been unexplainable, the NTSB has, to this day, never contacted General Parton, nor have they publicly raised the continuous rod warfare hypothesis. One of the features of the continuous rod warhead evident in the testing arena is the exceedingly bright flash when the expanding rods strike the aluminum side panels of the test chamber. This may have been what Roland Penny described to us as a silvery white light like a flashbulb, and it may have occurred when a continuous rod assembly cut through the aluminum skin of the jumbo. This fiery clash of metal on metal may have touched off the flames which provided the macabre offshore display to so many Long Islanders. In addition, Aviation Week and Space Technologies' September 23rd issue reported that investigators were, quote, puzzled by the damage just aft of the second main cabin doors and forward of the wing leading edges. The structure and skin here was blown away in small pieces, almost entirely around the circumference of the fuselage, end quote. This, ladies and gentlemen, is consistent with the Navy's flying buzzsaw description of the continuous rod warhead cutting this aircraft in half. This is the Voice of Freedom. Listening to the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network with studios in Eager, Arizona, broadcasting on satellite GE1, transponder 7, 7.56 audio, and over 700 FM stations across the nation and around the world. The Hour of the Time is also carried on WRMI, Worldwide Shortwave Radio, 99.55 kilohertz, Monday through Friday nights, 5 until 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
This is my daddy's station. I'm Pooh, classic radio like you always listed to be. 101.1 FM, Eager.
Cooper, and you're listening to the Hour of the Time. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I hope that you are sitting with your ear glued to your radio. And I know that so far you have heard enough to convict anybody in a court of law based upon the evidence that you have already heard that a missile struck that plane. And there's a lot more. An awful lot more. And there are some things that must be, of course, perused, looked at, examined, if you will. And we're going to do that. So don't touch that dial. know, ladies and gentlemen, why in a White House memo, President William Jefferson Clinton named me, William Cooper, the most dangerous radio host in America. The fire touched off immediately after the plane disappeared from radar, would likely be caused immediately after the rods cut through part of the center fuel tank and possibly the right wing tank where the wing's leading edge met the fuselage. This, ladies and gentlemen, would spew jet fuel out in a wide spray, which if not set alight by the initial aluminum flashes, would be ignited by the sparks of electricity from the vast tangle, hundreds, maybe thousands of miles of wire severed, which was running through the fuselage. Arkady Shipunov, the head of the Russian Instrument Design Bureau and member of the Russian Academy of Sciences, provides a further description of the rod's action. Quote, "The rod warhead disintegrates the flying vehicle airframe owing to the cutting action of rods against the body and incendiary effect against the engine." In fact, ladies and gentlemen, the Russians are quite enamored with their 57E6 Pantsir surface-to-air missile system featuring the elongated rod warhead system, and according to Shipunov, quote, "The employment of the 57E6 rod warhead allows the SAM to outperform the missiles of the same class fitted with the fragmentation warhead, 1.5 to 2 times in terms of effectiveness. The 57E6 missile surpasses the best world items of the same class system by 1.8 to 2.5 times, end quote. And for your information, SAM means surface-to-air missile. Unlike the United States submarine fleet, certain Russian submarines are fitted with a surface-to-air missile capability. In addition, although few are aware of it, Libya and Iran possess Russian submarines. Now, as outlandish as it might sound, the pattern of damage to the plane warrants that an act of state terrorism not yet be ruled out. In fact, Shipunov's rod warhead missile, the 57E6, has a modification allowing, quote, "versions placed on small ships, patrols and escorts," end quote. Now, if a rod warhead missile could be placed on a patrol boat, it could surely also be retrofitted to a large pleasure craft which could be scuttled deeper in the ocean after the launch. Thus, at least, the possibility exists for sophisticated terrorists to obtain such a Russian missile system with a small craft modification from one of Russia's, quote, former, end quote, client states, like Libya, for instance, Iran, or even Iraq. Remember, ladies and gentlemen, also, that terrorist Ramzi Yousaf was recently convicted of conspiring to blast 12 jumbo jets out of the sky simultaneously over the Pacific Ocean. Iraq expert Laurie Mallory, writing in the June 28, 1993 edition of the Wall Street Journal, revealed, quote, "The most important person in the Trade Center bombing is an Iraqi, Ramzi Ahmed Yousaf, known in New York as Rashid. Mr. Yusuf has 11 aliases. The United States press has reported that he left Iraq in early 1992, transiting Jordan to Pakistan. He entered New York in early September on Pakistan Airways. Mr. Yusuf, traveling on his Iraqi passport, passed through immigration by requesting asylum. End quote. Ms. Mylouri recently told investigators that further reason to suspect Iraq in the Flight 800 Downing lies in the tragedy's date. You see, July 17th is Iraq's National Day, similar in significance to that nation as our 4th of July. Mylouri also pointed out that the World Trade Center bombing came on the second anniversary of the liberation of Kuwait. Baghdad Radio has sworn revenge against George Bush and the United States of America. But do the Iraqis have access to the type of missile likely to have caused this explosion? Well, in the years leading up to the Gulf War, Iraq's top supplier of military hardware was the Soviet Union. For example, the infamous Scud missile has been a Soviet military staple. It is possible that Iraq possesses Russian-made continuous rod warhead missiles, perhaps of the type that could be released from a small craft or submarine off Long Island. Neither are the increasingly bellicose Chinese above suspicion, ladies and gentlemen. Remember, the New World Order is going to be a socialist phenomenon, and world socialism is controlled from Moscow. After United States Customs agents busted Chinese arms network broker Haman Ku last year, he revealed that the network could provide terrorists with handheld rocket launchers and surface-to-air missiles, although they would not have been able to shoot down TWA Flight 800. The fact is that they were dealing in surface-to-air missiles. The Los Angeles Times of May 24, 1996 wrote, quote, Ku boasted to customs agents that the surface-to-air missiles were so powerful that they could bring down a jumbo jet, end quote. Less than 2 months later, Flight 800 exploded. This is the same China which in November of 1995 issued a veiled threat that they could hit Los Angeles with a nuclear missile in the event the United States interfered militarily in the Chinese dispute with Taiwan. On Friday, January the 3rd, Dr. Whetley released the first autopsy reports to the attorneys for a few of the victims to assist in legal proceedings. Shortly after the crash, he stated that most of the victims either died instantly or were rendered unconscious at the time the plane exploded from what he referred to as the ultimate whiplash, the separation of the spine from the skull. These initial reports had stated that these cervical fractures occurred when the explosion caused a sudden deceleration of the plane from its approximately 400 mile per hour speed. One rescue worker told investigators, quote, many of the bodies were in perfect shape, not even blood on the clothes. He found two young girls floating in the water, still strapped in their seats. Their hair wasn't even ripped up. End quote. Incredibly, ladies and gentlemen, very few of the victims were burnt, despite the massive fireball. Many of the bodies may have escaped the blaze because they were sucked out of the plane when the proposed missile hit owing to the massive decompression of the cabin, or when the front end separated from the fuselage. Many had their clothes blown off. However, even those inside the fuselage during the massive fireball reportedly suffered little, if any, burn damage. This further suggests that the massive conflagration occurred when the wing tanks blew up, since the passengers were comparatively protected from direct flame burns inside the fuselage despite the inferno raging outside. Other bodies were badly damaged from blunt trauma caused by the impact with the ocean surface or from certain mechanisms unique to the cause of the crash. Initial reports indicated that there was no evidence of explosives fragments in the bodies, which was the coup de grace for the bomb theory. However, from our interviews with fishermen and others who actually pulled the bodies out of the water, there was significant evidence of the kind of massive blunt trauma expected from the impact of any among the various types of inert missiles, such as the continuous rod, blast fragmentation, or the kinetic kill vehicle warheads, which slam into the target at thousands of feet per second. In particular, those who were seated near such an event would be expected to have injuries consistent with this mechanism and entirely different from those further away. Sources close to the investigation have disclosed to investigators that the forensic evidence obtained by matching the seating arrangement with the precise mechanism of injury sustained by each passenger provides proof that it was a radar-guided proximity-fused missile which struck near the junction of the right wing's leading edge with the fuselage. This analysis may hold the key to identifying the exact type of missile involved. And, ladies and gentlemen, even further, we have learned from sources in the investigation itself that there is an indication that a small explosion occurred outside of the fuselage and under the wing before anything hit the aircraft. And there is evidence on the outside and under the wing of this explosion. Perhaps this is why, when investigators attempted to obtain a general analysis of the forensic explanation of the event, we were told by the Suffolk County Medical Examiner's Office that they are only scheduled to be released to individual families and their lawyers. What's more, the office, which appears to be effectively under the control of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, was unable to assure us that there would be a forensics report focusing on the possible causes of the crash. The medical examiner's office is simply turning over their autopsies to the FBI, and they stress that they have no duty to provide the press with the results of such an analysis. In fact, since the FBI is still maintaining the slim possibility that this was a criminal act, authorities are legally able to withhold the vital forensic evidence which can solve the puzzle of Flight 800. Freedom of Information Act requests will be denied in the still open criminal investigation. Finally, ladies and gentlemen, we come to the televised video evidence of the plane being struck by a missile. What, you say? If such evidence existed, we'd all have seen it, right? It would have been repeated over and over like the Rodney King beating, wouldn't it? Think again, ladies and gentlemen. When investigators been researching this story, we ran across an odd phenomenon, namely perfectly honest, credible people who claim to have seen nationally televised footage of Flight 800 showing the plane actually being struck by a rapidly rising ball of light from below on a collision course with the plane. I saw that footage myself on CNN shortly after this disaster occurred. One time it was shown and never shown again. The tape that was shown shows that when it struck, there was an explosion and the plane broke up and descended rapidly. The footage then cut off abruptly. Our research, ladies and gentlemen, indicates that the footage was aired within the first hour or two of the calamity, and it was shown by more than one of the major networks. Rose Cotton of Northampton, Massachusetts, told investigators of her experience on the evening of July 17, 1996. Quote, "I turned on my TV between 9 and 10, and there was coverage of the crash. Suddenly, my screen went blank, and a voice came on and said that an independent film crew had been filming on the island and had caught actual video footage of the explosion. Then there was a white light. I call it a missile now, and it came up from below and hit the front part of the right wing near the body of the plane, which exploded and started to fall apart. Then the film cut off, and it was shown a second time. After that, nothing was ever said about it again. End quote. Like the little boy who said, quote, the emperor doesn't have any clothes, end quote, Rose Cotton wrote a letter to the editor of the local Daily Hampshire Gazette describing what she had seen. To their credit, the Gazette editors printed it. Leanne Marzwinski of Macomb Township, Michigan, told investigators that she was watching one of the major networks' coverage of the crash when this footage was aired. Quote, I saw a little ball of light coming up from the bottom right of the screen toward the upper left. When it reached near the top of the screen, there was an explosion. It was dark, so you could barely see the plane, end quote. Leanne recalled the plane was going from the left side of the screen up toward the top center. Rose Cotton also saw the plane going from left to right across the screen. Of course, this would put the videographer out at sea, perhaps in a boat. Other witnesses described footage apparently shot from the beach, which showed the plane flying from right to left. Clearly, there was more than one Long Islander with a VCR out enjoying the water that evening. If any listener has a copy of this extraordinary footage, please contact us immediately. You may do so at 1-800-626-8944 or at 520-333-4578. That's 1-800-626-8944 and 520-333-4578. Now, could those who sold their video footage have possibly believed at the time that it would be shown once or twice and then dropped down an Orwellian memory hole just in time for the same networks to discredit the missile theory and later begin trotting out the latest expert warning about the dangers of static cling on jumbo jets just as all the initial footage in the coverage of the bombing of the Oklahoma City Mira federal building has disappeared and never been repeated, that proved that there were two blasts, that show and prove that what we've been told about that bombing is a lie? We have copies of all of that footage, ladies and gentlemen. Now we need copies of this footage. Investigators requested the above Flight 800 explosion footage from the file footage department of one major news network. Although the file footage clerk said he didn't recall any such tape, he noted that, quote, there is about an hour's gap in the airfeed footage, and that's what shows up on your TV screen, end quote, of that night's coverage. We asked him if he was sure, and he said that he was, but he didn't recall how it had disappeared. He then remembered that he was talking to a magazine editor and said, quote, wait a minute, are you doing a story on this? End quote. We said we were covering the Flight 800 crash. He responded, quote, that's all off the record. You can't print any of that, end quote. We are withholding the clerk's name and employer. Although you should be able to guess. The file footage clerk then sent us immediately to public affairs. Our interest piqued, we contacted a major national video archive to request the July 17th Flight 800 coverage broadcast by that network and others. The time we were given for the beginning of the Flight 800 coverage that night was fully 50 minutes after the time that the network's coverage on the event was actually aired. Now, if this doesn't tell you there is collusion between law enforcement and the government and the major networks, then I don't know what to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, about how your brain appears to be working, because it's absolute proof. Investigators contacted CNN to ask if they had obtained and shown the explosive footage. The CNN public affairs official immediately said, quote, I can't comment on that, end quote, and told us that the Vice President of Public Relations, Steve Hayward, would contact us. We told them we were on a deadline. However, 4 days later, despite our repeated messages, we received no return call. We don't call Ted Turner Ted Turncoat for nothing, ladies and gentlemen. The absence of blast damage effectively rules out the bomb theory, while the lack of a plausible ignition source demolishes the current mechanical malfunction theory. Although we believe that there is no question that a missile brought down the plane, one very vexing question remains. Whose missile was it? In order to even consider the possible suspects, we have to understand what kind of a missile was involved. The damage pattern is entirely consistent with certain very distinct types of surface-to-air missiles known as SAMs. Others can be discounted immediately. The missile theory was scuttled by the government and the press by using a clever strawman tactic. The only type of missile considered was of the shoulder-fired Stinger variety. Once this was discredited, and since no alternative missile kill mechanisms, continuous rod, blast fragmentation, or kinetic kill vehicle warhead were presented, the public was led to believe that the missile theory had been effectively ruled out, when in reality, it is the only theory which can explain all the available evidence. The shoulder fire missile theory falls apart, not because they are all heat seekers that run up the engine's tailpipe. They are not. And not because they aren't accurate at altitudes of over 13,000 feet. Later models are. And not even because they are virtually incapable of downing a jumbo jet. A lucky shot probably could. The problem is that it would not cause an immediate structural kill, and it would leave explosives residue and blast damage all over the plane. Some have proposed a dud stinger, or Bofors RBS-70. The shoulder fire theorists are left with a dud missile, approximately 4 inches in diameter, which on its way through the plane was somehow able to cut off all the voice box and flight data recorders and the radio communications and trigger the fuel tank explosion without the warhead going off. This hypothesis is itself a dud, ladies and gentlemen, since we know that the center fuel tank explosion occurred several seconds later, a mile beyond the initial event. Only the wide swath of a continuous rod warhead, or perhaps the shotgun blast of a blast fragmentation warhead, could have accomplished all of the damage that was done to that aircraft without showing blast damage or explosive residue. The fact that the plane separated into two large pieces several seconds after the initial event might tend to hurt the continuous rod warhead theory, since the plane should have broken apart immediately after the missile arrived. But the final position of the front end of the plane is consistent with its separation from the fuselage at the time of the initial event at an altitude of 2.4 miles in the sky. With the favorable aerodynamics of the nose, its momentum, and the plane was traveling just under 400 miles per hour, folks, could have carried the nose to its resting place slightly less than 2 miles from the initial event. And experts have assured us that that is exactly what has happened. Sources close to the investigation have confirmed to investigators that the initial event involved the separation of the plane's nose section from the fuselage, followed by a 4 or more second delay prior to the fireball, which apparently split the remainder of the plane into two large pieces, as was reported by witnesses. And ladies and gentlemen, there are so many witnesses that I'd like to see anybody go head-to-head with them. It would be the end of the Challenger. Don't touch that dial. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, the Hour of the Time is brought to you by Swiss America Trading. Our people in Phoenix who have provided the airtime that makes this broadcast possible all around the world. When I was broadcasting to the world from Waco, Texas, with the warning that if we did not stop what was happening there immediately, all those people would be murdered. The enemies of freedom burned WWCR to the ground. Within 24 hours, Swiss America Trading had us on another station, WRNO, out of New Orleans. And we continued to broadcast the truth to the world from the scene in Waco, Texas, and my prediction came true. They were all murdered. It is now known as the Waco Massacre. The world would never have known what really happened there had not Swiss America Trading supported this broadcast. And no one would have become upset about it. There would have been no hearings, no uncovering of the true facts, unless Linda Thompson had produced her videotape, Waco, the Big Lie. It is this kind of support, ladies and gentlemen, that makes it possible for the world to discover the truth. The truth, ladies and gentlemen, is what really happens in any given situation, and the truth is elusive at best, I can assure you, because that is my job to deal with and uncover the truth. Contact Swiss America Trading. Thank them for sponsoring this broadcast. Ask for a current copy of the newsletter. Ask how you can get your hands on some real money, and then do it. 1-800-289-2646. That's 1-800-289-2646. You'll be glad that you did. Look around you at the faces of your loved ones. If you cannot assure them at this very moment that you have placed at least a part of your assets in non-confiscatable, non-reportable, real money, gold and silver coins, then how, in all conscience, can you tell them that you love them? Well, we're headed for a fall, and only those who are prepared are going to survive that fall. 1-800-289-2646. 1-800-BUY-COIN. Design engineer at the Navy's Missile Division with over 30 years of experience in the field told investigators that if a missile downed the plane, it would have had to have been fired from relatively close range. Now, ladies and gentlemen, listen very closely. He says it would have had to have been fired from relatively close range since the rocket motors on a long-range missile traveling 100 miles or more would have long since burned out and thus would no longer put out a smoke trail or vapor contrail and would therefore be rendered invisible to any shore-based onlookers. The fact is, all of the witnesses whom our investigators took testimony reported a very short period of time from seeing the missile launch from the surface of the water until it went up in a parabola and hit TWA Flight 800. They described it as very similar to a rocket at a 4th of July celebration. This effectively rules out the oft-raised possibility of a standard missile SM-2 IVA being fired from the USS Normandy, for example, assuming it was, as the Navy claims, 180 miles to the south near Chesapeake Bay at the time of the disaster. Thus, all though the SM-2 IVA, which is an advanced long-range anti-ballistic missile designed to shoot down other missiles, may indeed have the range, it would be invisible to onlookers at the time of impact. The missile that actually hit TWA Flight 800 was seen in its flight path from the time of launch until the time of impact. This expert, who did not believe the friendly fire scenario took place, and neither do I, ladies and gentlemen, noted that if the launch had been too close to the shore, the pretty spectacular display of the missile taking off from a cruiser, for example, would be visible to onlookers. In fact, it would have caused such a display that everyone would still be talking about it. Because I've seen missile launches from ships at sea many times during my naval career. On the other hand, the same expert conceded that if a missile was fired from over the horizon, 20 to 30 miles further out to sea than the jumbo jet, the launch would likely have been missed by shore witnesses, especially since it occurred before nightfall, and the rocket motor would still be burning so that the smoke or vapor contrail described by witnesses would indeed be visible. Several individuals who took part in the rescue efforts, such as Roland Penny, told investigators that although the sky was very clear that day, visibility was markedly decreased just over the water where dense haze obstructed the view. Thus, at a distance of, say, 20 or 30 miles from shore, the spectacular liftoff of a missile might have been obscured. It wouldn't have to be that far away, ladies and gentlemen, for a man 6 feet tall standing at sea level can only see 5 miles over water. Nevertheless, the 154 credible eyewitnesses out of the total of over 300 that were interviewed, sources close to the investigation told investigators that almost 36 claimed they saw the streak of light originate at the ocean surface. The November 25th issue of Aviation Week and Space Technology confirmed the striking similarity in the eyewitness sightings of the light streak that rose to meet the plane. Quote, according to officials, the agents said they concentrated on about 30 eyewitnesses, judged to be particularly credible. They said the agents reported that Bureau investigators had triangulated the sightings of each witness, which generally correlated with a common location for the streaks of light, end quote. James Kallstrom, the head of the FBI's New York office, tried to dispel rumors that the Navy accidentally shot down the jumbo jet, saying, quote, we have totally and thoroughly investigated all aspects of the so-called friendly fire theory and have not found one scintilla of evidence that would indicate any involvement of U.S. military forces in this tragedy. It is highly, highly, highly unlikely, end quote. Now, ladies and gentlemen, where you have someone committing a crime, even if it is an accident, nevertheless a crime, where there are a small number of people involved in committing that crime, it is possible to keep such a thing secret. But where you have the possibility of launching a surface-to-air missile from a large United States Navy cruiser that has as a crew hundreds of men, some of them disappointed in their naval career, some of them angry at their petty officers and officers, it is absolutely impossible. I can tell you this. I spent many years as a senior petty officer in the United States Navy. I can tell you that not one, not two, not three, not four, but many of the ship's crew would have already come forth to tell the world if it had actually been a missile fired from the United States Navy ship. You see, there's no way to prevent or control large numbers of people when such a thing occurs. That's why MELI eventually surfaced and had to be dealt with in the spotlight of the world. As I have already noted, our sources close to the investigation disclosed that the streaks of light so triangulated had originated inside the W-105 Navy warning area approximately 20 miles offshore. The question becomes, were there any ships in the area? Captain McLean, the Eastland Airlines pilot, told investigators that he does not recall seeing any ships. However, ships on maneuver at night would have been running without lights, ladies and gentlemen. It's a normal occurrence with Navy vessels during maneuvers, because in wartime, you run with ship darkened, so to speak, so that enemy vessels cannot locate you, enemy aircraft cannot spot you. Captain McLean was heading in a southwesterly direction, and he may not have been looking southeast to the very large W-105 warning area. So it's still possible that there was something out there. Frank Jackson, who was on a fishing boat less than 5 miles from the crash, told investigators that he saw no Navy ships or any other large vessels in the area that day, and his boat's radar, which is accurate to 6 miles, did not see anything of that magnitude. However, Jackson, who would later distinguish himself in the recovery efforts, did caution that it was very hazy on the water and the surface visibility was only 3 miles, so he could not rule out ships being present on or near the horizon. The first hint of a friendly fire cover-up came shortly after the event, when the infamous Navy scuttlebutt began to buzz about the possibility of an accidental shootdown during a maneuver off the coast of Long Island. There were triple hearsay rumors, not only of the shootdown, but of sailors telling their parents they were on the ship that had shot it down, and of others looking for legal representation after they were told to keep quiet about the accident. The first truly credible source charging a Navy shootdown was Richard Russell, a 30-year veteran aircraft accident investigator, formerly with the Airline Pilots Association. Russell, a retired United Airlines 747 pilot, sent a stunning one-page report on the incident to a select few of his friends and associates in the industry. He told investigators that he had received the information from his trusted industry government sources, which participated in a high-level briefing after the disaster. The information, which included satellite footage, indicated that the Navy shot down the plane by accident. Before he knew it, and without his permission, the report was all over the Internet. Russell wrote, quote, TWA Flight 800 was shot down by a United States Navy Aegis missile system fired from a guided missile ship, which was in area W-105, about 30 miles from where TWA Flight 800 exploded. W-105 is a warning area off the southeast coast of Long Island and is used by the military for military operations, including missile firing. It is believed that while W-105 is a rather large area, budget constraints have dictated that missile firings be done closer to land, so that the flight time for the P-3 monitor and tracking aircraft can be reduced, end quote. Now, I'm going to tell you right now, ladies and gentlemen, if the United States Navy shot down TWA Flight 800, not one, not two, not three, but many of the crew members will eventually come forward and tell the world what happened. If that does not happen, then I'm going to also tell you right now that the United States Navy did not shoot down TWA Flight 800 accidentally or on purpose or under any other circumstances whatsoever. Russell wrote that TWA 800, whose departure was 1 hour late, was unexpectedly restricted to 13,700 feet because of a United States air flight above it cleared to 21,000 feet. Russell suggests that the Navy was not expecting any planes at the lower altitude, which may have led to the accidental shootdown. One friendly fire theory has the missile homing in on a radar reflection off the jumbo jet that is far stronger than that of the intended target drone. The radar comes from a Navy-guided missile cruiser directing the exercise from many miles away. even though the jumbo is outside the active warning area, the missile is drawn to the more powerful radar signal reflected from the giant airliner and ignores the tiny drone. Just after the election on November 8th, another heavy hitter weighed in, putting his considerable reputation on the line. Veteran journalist Pierre Salinger told a gathering of airline executives at Cannes, France, that he had information from the United States Secret Service by way of his French intelligence contacts that the United States Navy accidentally shot down the plane. Here was the former press secretary for John F. Kennedy and longtime network commentator and author boldly stating that the United States Navy not only did in the plane, but is refusing to admit it. Salinger was rapidly attacked by the major media, which said that his source was Richard Russell's report on the Internet. The press was able to scuttle both Salinger and the Internet by laughing at the respected newsman for getting his information from the ha-ha-ha Internet. Of all places. And folks, there is a lot of junk floating around there, but there's also a lot of truth. Russell has since met with Salinger, seen his documents, and told this editor that there is no question that Salinger's information came from official U.S. sources. And I'm going to tell you right now, folks, that I have also read the document in its entirety, and I can tell you that it is so full of inaccuracies, outright lies, and misinformation, such as TWA Flight 800 was shot down by a United States Navy Aegis missile. Ladies and gentlemen, there is no such thing in the entire arsenal of the United States Navy as an Aegis missile. If you don't believe me, you look it up and you will find out. There is an Aegis-class cruiser, which is a ship. Ships cannot leave the water and jump up in the air and hit aircraft. At least, not any of the ships that I was ever on. And I really don't think there are that anyone was ever on. The Navy warning areas were activated that night. We have obtained the Navy and FAA's warning and restricted areas information log from July 17th through 18th, belying the Navy's initial denials. The logs indicate they had indeed reserved the warning area known as Warning 105, W-105, from the ocean up to 6,000 feet for the 17th of July through 12:30 on the 18th. This means, ladies and gentlemen, it was activated for possible use during the time Flight 800 was flying just 15 miles north of its northerly border. When a Navy warning area is activated, the FAA notifies pilots to stay out of the area. Aviation maps are explicit. Warning, National Defense Operating Area. Operations hazardous to the flight of aircraft conducted within this area. Maneuvers involving planes, submarines, and ships with frequent missile launches are routine in these test ranges, which cover vast stretches of ocean. In addition to 105, at least one other area was activated at the time of the crash. According to journalist David Hendricks of the Riverside, California Press Enterprise, a special exercise area below 10,000 feet, just south of W-105, was activated at 8 p.m. while Flight 800 was still taxiing on the tarmac at John F. Kennedy Airport. Further support for the Navy accident theory is seen in the accepted fact that a P-3 Orion anti-submarine warfare plane had just passed about 6,000 feet above Flight 800 only seconds prior to the explosion. East Wind Airlines pilot David McLean told investigators that the P-3 was about 15 miles away at the time of the crash and later radioed to ask whether it should assist with the, quote, accident, end quote. McLean stated that this choice of words wasn't necessarily a reference to a Navy accident, as some have suggested. The term, ladies and gentlemen, is the accepted terminology for pilots to report the crash of a large plane. The term, quote, incident, end quote, is used for smaller aircraft. The United States Navy initially stated that there were no other assets in the area, but later revealed that the P-3 was coordinating with a submarine off the coast of Cape May, New Jersey. See Newsday, August 20, 1996. They stressed that it was not equipped with surface-to-air missiles. It is true, ladies and gentlemen, that United States submarines do not possess a SAM capability on the norm, but there are some special class submarines that can carry and launch surface-to-air missiles. At any rate, we have an anti-submarine P-3 plane in the area, which carries no air-to-air missiles. We have at least one submarine nearby, and we have at least two activated warning areas. Were there any surface ships in addition to the distant USS Normandy, which the Navy claims was 180 miles south off Chesapeake Bay? Richard Russell told investigators that even that location is in doubt, since the Navy has refused to release surface pictures, which are satellite photos, of all Navy ships in that area that night, which could help to diffuse friendly fire concerns. Unfortunately, we are at the mercy of the same Pentagon information source which for 5 years lied and covered up the existence of the devastating Gulf War syndrome. David Hendricks of the Riverside, California Press Enterprise has done extensive and high-quality research into the disaster. He quoted a retired senior Pentagon official who noted that a large warning area would not have been restricted, quote, just for a simple P-3 fly-through to see if he can talk to a submerged submarine, end quote. Hendricks wrote, quote, details of the night's scheduled military events remain locked in official secrecy, end quote. The Riverside County Press Enterprise, October 4, 1996. To add further intrigue to an already tantalizing brew, Hendricks told investigators that the P-3 Orion squadron, the VP-11 in Brunswick, Maine, was scheduled to be disbanded at the end of 1997. Hendricks found that the squadron, nicknamed the Proud Pegasus, has been around since 1954 and had received funding through the end of 1997. Yet, on September the 1st, scarcely a month after the tragedy, the unit was abruptly disbanded and the men dispersed to other units around the world. Can the fail-safes fail? Well, I have to tell you that they can under certain circumstances, but it's not easy. Despite the friendly fire scenario's plausibility, official Navy sources told investigators that long before an errant missile approached a warning boundary, it would self-destruct. If this failed, the command vessel would destroy it with the press of a button, and that is Navy standard operating procedure. Nevertheless, there are plausible-sounding theories as to how these fail-safe mechanisms could have failed, especially through human error during advanced live-fire naval maneuvers involving multiple missiles. David Hendricks told investigators that his sources, who worked at such warning area coordinating centers as the Oceana Fleet Air Operations Center on the Virginia coast, assured him that it was entirely possible. And as he wrote in the Enterprise, one source, a retired Navy officer, quote, who used to supervise warning areas, said he strongly believes the friendly fire theory may be true, end quote. So we're giving you all sides of this, ladies and gentlemen. Nobody knows who owns the missile or who fired the missile that hit TWA Flight 800. But we can prove beyond any shadow of a doubt whatsoever that it was a missile that brought that aircraft down. There is no confusion on that point. And indeed, as we all know, if we've been paying attention, friendly fire incidents do occur. Probably thousands of them occurred in Vietnam alone. Reportedly, in the Gulf War, more U.S. servicemen were killed by fratricide than by the Iraqi army, and I believe that that is possibly true. The United States Navy's guided missile cruiser, the Vincennes, did shoot down an Iranian 747 jumbo jet on July the 3rd, 1988 in the Persian Gulf, killing everyone aboard. Granted, the event took place in a war zone. The Iran-Iraq war was still raging, and the Vincennes thought they were being attacked by a missile-firing fighter jet. But the downing was, by whatever standard one uses, a mistake on the part of the Vincennes. Richard Russell cited numerous instances around the world in which test missiles had narrowly missed commercial jetliners, including a recent case involving a British airliner over Turkey. A more recent non-combat example of a missile straying out of a tightly controlled test zone was reported to have occurred off the coast of Virginia just over a month after the Flight 800 disaster. And the Associated Press reported that on August 29th at 1:45 p.m., the pilot of an American Airlines 757 flying from Puerto Rico to Boston reported seeing a missile off the right wing while very close to NASA's Wallop Island unmanned rocket test facility. I have talked to that pilot, and his account is exactly what happened. To him, not to Flight 800, ladies and gentlemen, for nobody knows exactly how it occurred or who did it. We do know that a missile, without any doubt whatsoever, brought down TWA Flight 800, ladies and gentlemen, and don't you ever forget it. Good night, ladies and gentlemen. God bless each and every single one of you. And may God save this republic. Gentlemen, a portion of tonight's broadcast was taken from my friend Philip M. O'Halloran's excellent magazine, Relevance. A regular subscription is $110, and if you'd like to subscribe, call 1-800-626-8944. That's 1-800-626-8944. Portions of tonight's broadcast were taken from the research of the Intelligence Service, the CAGI News Service, and Ian Williams Goddard.